Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, September 22nd, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, back by very popular choice, Adam Trombley, to talk about zero-point energy. Adam was just on in August, and we did a wonderful show on entrainment technology, subliminal programming, and financial applications thereof. And if you haven't heard it, I really encourage you to also listen to that one as well. We've had the new blog up now for 2 weeks, and it's going great. You've already been posting comments and questions. So I'm very excited. Our feedback is this is making the resources much more accessible. We're able to put the links up quickly that we talk about in the Solari Report. We have the charts there as well. Again, Darlene Heckman runs our customer service. She's absolutely fantastic, loves to talk to people. Her number is 888-686-3354. If you have any trouble, please let Darlene know. We want to make sure that the Solari Report experience is excellent for you. Our theme tonight is writing a new story. I have just been amazed at the sense of people feeling overwhelmed by the bad financial news. And I think it's so important to remember that our problems are political, they're not economic. So what looks like an economic or financial problem is really something that's happening as a result of politics. And there really is quite a lot to be optimistic about if you look at the deeper story. I just said into the blog, it'll be posted tomorrow, the BBC News reports that the folks over in Switzerland at the physicists at CERN report that they're recording subatomic particles exceeding the speed of light, and they can't explain it, but it would upend a century of physics. So they're not quite sure what to think and are inviting comment from the wider scientific community. But it's just a reminder that I think as the old model dies, there's a lot that can open up, and we need to write a new story, not just the sort of negative story that's being written by many of the folks at the top. Part of writing a new story, I think, is facing the intimacy of our complicity in the current model. And every time I think I've faced all the evil in my own life, I discover, what is that line, wait, there's more. With that in mind, I published a new special Solari report, one that our team has been working on for many, many weeks. It's called William Diefendurfer, The Financial Hitmen of Student Loans. It is right now just available to subscribers. Sometime next week we'll make it available to a wider audience. There was very significant research. We pulled out all the SEC documents, public filings, to show you sort of how the money works, lobbying revenues, board revenues, stock options, the whole gamut. And what it really does is give you an example of the profits of engineering failure, and this time the failure of our young people. And to me, that's just about as bad as it gets, because the young people really are our future. And I'm a great believer that we owe our children a great education without debt. And what's been happening in the student loan area is just the worst of the worst, because it is the engineering of the failure of the future itself. So, ugly story, but there's a lot in that story, I think, which we can all learn about the change we're coming into. Money and markets. Our theme in the markets this week was the big shrink. We see deflation in many currencies around the world, stock prices and asset values. The only thing rising today was the U.S. dollar, which topped over 78. My bet it's going to hit 80 before this move is over. The Dow was down 391 points. If you look at the Morgan Stanley All-Country World Index for 45 nations, it was down. It's now lost more than 20% since May 2nd. That meets the definition of a bear market. So a very significant slide. If you look at the smart money looks to me like it's buying precious metals, not selling. So I'm a hold. Precious metals got whacked almost 4%. Gold got whacked almost 4% today, and then it's bouncing back now overnight with buying and presumably in Asia. for those buying, I don't think it's, I think it's still too early. I want to see where it lands next Monday, which is usually the day when more push down comes on. So I'm just watching. Stuart Thompson of Graceland Updates, who was on the Solari Report early this year, who always makes me laugh, says he's talking about the banksters trying to knock people, get people to sell their gold and silver. He says, many of you are still trading too big. I told you that the banksters would grab the gold community by the hair and make them look down from the gold skyscraper and look down at the ground and say, what if you and your gold fell all the way down there? What if you were splattered all over the price concrete? Do you know how horrible that would be? Just do the right thing and sell out now. Then he says, this is not preppy day. This is shut the quote machine off and get out of their day if there is any temptation to hand the banksters what you have. Very funny. The global unemployment continues to increase political tensions. That's going to get worse. It's, you know, until we really fundamentally address the model, I think unemployment is going to be a bigger and bigger problem. A lot of this week's fears in the markets related not just to global recession and unemployment, but tensions in Europe. The structure of the euro as a currency currently, as it's configured, doesn't work, as we talked about last week. As a currency, the dollar is structurally is much stronger, but obviously we we have our own debasement problems. The Fed engineered Operation Twist, shifting using issuance of short term to buy in the long term. The sort of luminaries of the financial blogosphere were on a discussion on email today talking about what they thought this meant. So, of course, I went in with my opinion, and I just wanted to read it to you. My guess is that they're buying in long-term MBS from the large financial institutions in the U.S. and Europe and perhaps in Asia. This is a continuation of the mortgage cleanup laundry they've been running covertly by declaring emergencies around storms, tornadoes, and droughts. By allowing a put into a series of government-controlled agencies, they can tear up the files and take the write-downs on the federal balance sheet. This puts them in a position to shift the cleansed assets back out to the financial institutions, who can reposition the redevelopment now that they own them at a fraction of the cost. The real estate and housing markets cannot clear because the total fraud is too great, so they need to laundromat them through the U.S. balance sheet federal credit. They seem to be giving it time, as a poor economy is necessary to persuade retirees to accept the cuts they want to deliver. Bank of America rocketed to success after the Great Depression as a result of their inventory of foreclosed properties. It's an old model and has worked many times before. In fact, the same sort of taking in the not or the weak paper is being repeated in Europe. One subscriber writes in, while all eyes are on the Fed, ECB has abolished requirements that debt instruments must be tradable on regulated markets. They've also dropped limits on unsecured bank-issued debt as ECB collateral to 5% from 10%. Bank funding just got easier in ECB de facto ease. Looks like anything goes at the ECB in exchange for funds, thanks to the global centrals making big dollars available. The wild card again in all of this, and that's why I'm so glad Adam could join us tonight, is technology. I keep watching for the next big primary trend, the reshifting and repositioning of the mortgage files and the repositioning of real estate. And, of course, the big question mark is technology. On a very interesting front, we had a story at the beginning of the week that Siemens Energy, big German energy company, deposits $500 million with the ECB. This was taken by some to be a bank run because they were pulling it out, presumably of the French banks. I didn't say anything because it didn't look like that to me. And sure enough, the next day we have an announcement that Siemens, let me just read it, Siemens, the largest energy conglomerate in Europe, this is up on the blog, announced Sunday that following the German government's decision to phase out nuclear power by 2022, it would stop building nuclear power plants anywhere in the world. The chapter for us is closed. Now, this is really big. For the largest engineering conglomerate to say goodbye to nuclear, the question is, what are they saying hello to, and what does that have to do with $500 million shifted into the ECB? Big question. The building of global empire continues. Stratford came out with a story. Let me just read it. The Obama administration is building secret unmanned aerial vehicle bases for counterterrorism operations in the Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, and names specifically Ethiopia, the Seychelles, and one other place, as part of a new campaign targeting al-Qaeda affiliates in Somalia and Yemen, U.S. officials say. The Washington Post reported September 21st, the CIA is also building an airstrip in the Arabian Peninsula to allow for the deployment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so we're putting drones all over the Middle East. This is not about terrorists. It's about bank deposits and selling treasury securities. If we have armed, unmanned aerial vehicles all over the world, I can assure you that everybody will be depositing in our banks. With that in mind, there is a very interesting story, it's up on the blog, about the decision in the Seventh Circuit to allow two Americans to proceed to sue Rumsfeld over the interrogation and torture techniques. It's a very interesting story, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to Rumsfeld. Our hero this week is a very, very special man. I had not realized that he passed away in August of cancer. Ray Anderson, the chairman of Interface, an Atlanta businessman who decided that he was going to, he sort of got the environmental passion, and he was going to figure out how to convert his entire manufacturing and distribution operation to a company that left the earth better than it found it. And his accomplishments in that effort were absolutely extraordinary. If you've ever seen the documentary, The Corporation, you'll see some footage of Ray Anderson and see what a special and extraordinary person he is. So it's that's a life worth learning about, because it's another wonderful example of what one person can do. Okay, I'm going to hold off questions on Ask Catherine, because I want to get as much time as I possibly can with Adam. I've promised him that we could go as long as we wanted. I had gone extra time when he was here to talk about entrainment and subliminal programming, and was soundly criticized by several subscribers. I can hear Adam in the background. By several subscribers, because we didn't go long enough. They said, oh, I wish you hadn't stopped. So I promised him we can go as long as we want. And I'm thrilled that he's back, because Adam is somebody who spent a lifetime researching and exploring real solutions, including energy technology. He's not just a physicist and a scientist, but an inventor in his own right. So without further ado, let me introduce him. Adam, are you with us?
I am.
All right. Okay, well, I'm going to ask you this question again, because I've been reading and reading and reading, because I just warn you, Adam, as you know, I'm way out of my depth here. What in the world is zero-point energy?
This is the $64,000 question, isn't it? It's interesting to me, because it's been something that's been topical in certain areas of physics for nearly a century now. And the zero point vacuum fluctuation background energy is basically nomenclature that's applied to describe the energy that exists outside of the normal electromagnetic thermal spectrum. In other words, below 0 degrees Kelvin, is there still something that causes, is there still fluctuation, is there still density perturbations that exist in the background energy? And Heisenberg speculated that there were these fluctuations that existed, and Tesla, without using the same nomenclature, the same language, he called the cosmic energy, he basically tapped into it and demonstrated that it could be reduced to practice. In other words, that he could actually derive electrical power from the background field. This was done actually before the end of the 1800s, so this is a 19th century discovery, long before Heisenberg actually ever speculated about it. Back in the day when Tesla actually kind of into this discovery, he basically was confronted with a community of science which was trying to redefine itself. In the 19th century, there had been an embrace of ether and all particles being kind of precipitates or condensates of ether. And then there were certain experiments carried out that seemed to refute the existence of ether by two scientists named Michelson and Morley. And as Einstein said at Leiden University before he got out of Europe, and before Hitler had taken it over altogether, he said, it isn't that we're saying that there is no ether, it's just that the characteristics of the ether are not what we had formerly presumed. And so the zero-point vacuum fluctuation background is this energy which by 1962 was described by the dean of physics at Princeton, a wonderful man named John Archibald Wheeler, who I was privileged to know and converse with several times at length about this phenomenon. In 1962, in the Review of Modern Physics, and anybody who's familiar with my work knows that I frequently quote this paper, he said that if you took the Planck wavelength, which is an extremely small wave of energy, electromagnetic energy, which is 10 to the minus 33rd power, okay, centimeters. So this is extremely tiny wave. And if you made that the limitation on the size of the fluctuation that pervades all time and space, that in fact the mass energy equivalent of the zero point field is 10 to the 93rd power grams per cubic centimeter. So he was basically saying that the potential energy pervading all space, every arbitrarily chosen cubic centimeter of space, is 10 to the 93rd power grams. Well, this is like the amount of energy that we ascribe to our known universe, okay, pervading every cubic centimeter. And at one conference I was at many years ago, wonderful Japanese physicist named Shinichi Seiki said, it basically means that, well, this is a hallucination in a certain sense. This is not nearly as solid and as real as we presume it to be. And I don't mean this as any kind of sarcastic comment or anything like that. What I'm basically saying is that this field, which is all pervading, this field which is not sourced by mass, and this is another big fork in this description, because there are scientists who say that the zero-point vacuum fluctuation energy is actually the byproduct of mass. And basically, since Tesla first described the cosmic background and since we have been working with this for so very long, there's a whole other school in the physics community that says that, no, in fact, mass itself is the condensate form or is a precipitate of this background energy, and that every atom and molecule in this moment that comprises you and I and everything we see and everything we don't see, for that matter, is actually being the dynamic modification of this field. It only exists as a dynamic modification of this field. It has what we call temporal integrity. It exists in time, and therefore we all seem to exist in it, and we perceive it, and we kind of ignore it, quite frankly. I mean, it's there, but it's like, who cares if it's there if you can't make use of it? And I remember in the early 70s, I was in a seminar, and the topic of the seminar was zero-point vacuum fluctuation energy. And I brought up to this group of 12 or 13 people who were in the room, why is it that we presume we cannot tap into it and use this as a source of energy? And you would have thought that I had just made a very lewd gesture of some sort. It was like the energy in the room shifted so intensely. And I was taken aside on a break during that seminar, and which was a graduate seminar, and I was taken aside by one of the professors, and he told me that if I ever hoped to see tenure, that I would never ask that question again. And I said, and why is that? And he said, because that would be a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. You know, basically, you can never you know, and it would be a violation of conservation of energy to suggest that you can get more energy out of the background field than you put into it. And I said, well, you know, but you have the atmosphere. I used an analogy, an atmospheric analogy, and in a clear blue sky, two weather fronts confront one another. One's a high pressure front, one's a low pressure front. And they not only have a big thermal differential, but they have an electromagnetic, an electrodynamic differential in terms of charge concentration. And so one hour or 2 hours ago, we had a perfectly clear sky, and now we've got a one-mile-wide tornado. And that tornado is being the dynamic modification of the atmosphere in which it appears. It is, its constituent elements are comprised primarily of the atmosphere in which it appears. And the same thing is true of every electron, every boson, every particle in existence. But we are learning more and more about this phenomena. We're learning more and more about Bose-Einstein condensates. We're learning more and more about what we can precipitate from the field. And as a matter of fact, this is an extremely important thing for people to understand, and yet we have not been given the educational tools because we have been systematically undereducated when it comes to this subject and several others, which is a curious thing indeed. And I have been working in this field for so very long now, and I have had so many conversations in so many different venues across this planet, and I know so many very credible people in terms of their own scientific reputations, et cetera, that in private conversation are willing to talk about this, but are unwilling because of a lack of courage, more than a lack of integrity, I think, sometimes. I think sometimes it's just scary for people because they don't want to take a controversial stand. I've been very blessed in my life to be an R.J. Reynolds scholar and beyond that to have private funding for decades now, and I'm very grateful for that. And so I've been able to be outspoken about this and not have to worry about losing my job tomorrow, which most people do have to worry about, quite frankly. So I don't have to be concerned about that and any shenanigans of people trying to discredit me and all of those things, which there are certain people who have been, you know, just doing that for years now. It don't really bother me at all because I know that eventually if we need to embrace this, we need to understand that we are all pervaded by this field, that the reason why when your Aunt Barbara is thinking of calling you or your sister or your brother or your lover or your friend is thinking of calling you and you suddenly see their face in your head and then the phone rings and you go, well, I was just thinking of you. We all have this happen. This is because there isn't really anything separating this, the person who is going to call us and who then does call us, the person who is thinking of us, okay, there is nothing really separating us. This space between us is not empty space. It is not a vacuum. It is pervaded by this sea of energy. We are completely, intimately, and always connected by this sea of energy. And one of the most exciting areas of physics, which is proving this more and more every month as I go through my American Physical Society literature, for example, the Physical Review letters, every single week, actually, there's almost something new about entanglement. New experiments showing greater distances, more and more macro-sized systems that are showing entanglement. We all know there's entanglement because we all experience it, but we haven't been empowered to understand that this is because there is no such thing as disconnection from the field in which we appear. There is no such thing as separation from this. And that that there's ultimately no such thing as a singularity that lasts for eternity. And so, you know, this has been something that since Nikola Tesla, we have actually had technological reductions to practice that demonstrate this phenomena. But even before Nikola Tesla, it can help us understand what is normally thought of as magic or what is normally thought of as, you know, like, how did Jesus dance on the water? Okay. I mean, how did I mean, how do these things happen? And it didn't just happen at Jesus or with Jesus. It has happened. Healing has happened. It's all kinds of wonderful, spontaneously, seemingly impossible things have happened. My life is full of miracles because I have understood for a really long time, just through this blessing, I have understood for a very long time that I am not a separate being from this field. And that I also have been blessed to understand that I'm not the source of it. So I haven't suffered the megalomaniac phenomena that some of my friends actually have. But this is the thing. The American people and the people of this planet deserve to know that the zero-point vacuum fluctuation field, the quantum ether, whatever nomenclature people want to ascribe to it, exists. If it didn't exist, there wouldn't be entanglement between objects at great distances. You have an electron that communicates with another electron at a great distance instantaneously and way transcends the speed of light. Superluminal is what we call it. And
I'm
there
always,
are people
you know,
who
Adam,
say...
I'm always asking you about that experiment when that was proved. You've heard the story. I was driving down the George Washington Parkway listening to the Dancing Woolly Masters, and they described that experiment, and I had to stop the car. It was late at night. Get out, and I was walking up and down the side of the road screaming, I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. That was a life-changing moment.
Sure.
Maybe, could you just take a second and describe that experiment more carefully, because it
the
two atoms acted simultaneously further than the speed of light and sound.
Honestly, Catherine, at this point, to describe one experiment would be almost disingenuous to me, because there have been hundreds and hundreds of experiments. I mean, literally every week when I get my physical review letters, I go through, and I'm really serious. There's a new proof of entanglement. And the systems are larger and larger. Not only that, but we are engineering systems that we can communicate instantaneously. One of my colleagues from Germany basically communicated from Munich to Australia instantaneously by a kind of engineered entanglement. And communicated data this way. Dr. Müller is his name. And we have so many things that are happening that will completely blow the old economy away. I mean, the old energy economy, the old banking system, the old economic stratifications. We have so many things that are happening in science right now that if we could not have this be suppressed, we could emerge from all deficits. Imagine an economy that doesn't depend on fossil fuel and nuclear, which, of course, thanks be to God, Siemens announces this wonderful announcement that you were just talking about how they're not going to ever build another nuclear power plant. Now, how can Siemens, and now I've been in conversation with Siemens, with different individuals at Siemens, since November of 1980 when I first lectured in Hanover at the first international conference on tachyon field energy. And so, I mean, I know Siemens has had active interest in zero point, and I'm not saying I know everything that they've been doing behind the scenes, but I can tell you that the U.S. ambassador from Germany, the ambassador from basically came to the Aspen Institute a couple of years ago and at the Environment Forum announced this, that they were going to be free of all fossil fuels and all non-sustainable, all non-renewable. You know, they were going to be free of all of that by 2030. And it was an astonishing statement, because we had, you know, a couple of gurus of, we had the president of Shell Oil and Amory Lovins, who's been working with Shell Oil for now, he announced that day for over 30 years as one of his primary patrons. And these are people who, I'm not questioning their sincerity, I'm not questioning even that they believed what they were saying necessarily, because they were saying that by 2030 that we would maybe have between, I think, 35 and 45% non-renewable. In other words, we would be an alternative energy 35 to 45%, depending on which one of those speakers were speaking. And the German ambassador just said, who wasn't, by the way, scheduled to speak, he just said up there on the stage, he says, no, by 2030, we're going to be completely free of it because Germany knows this is real. Germany knows it's not just about solar. It's not just about wind. God bless solar and God bless wind energy. We need them. We, at the Institute for Advanced Studies, utilize them. We have a couple really good installations. Our new installation in Tucson is quite exciting. Even though it's just a solar installation, it is something that can be done. It takes up a lot of space. It costs a lot of money. And we know for a fact that when zero-point vacuum fluctuation-based devices go into production, that it will cost a lot less than solar. It'll cost a lot less than wind. It won't kill birds. It won't be subject to fluctuations of climate. It won't be subject to whether the clouds are happening that day or that month, you know, in the monsoons, for example. It'll give us the kind of independence that it's hard for us to even imagine. And I'm not talking about flying around in our zero-point personal Porsche flying saucers necessarily, which was the former head of the Office of Technology Assessment, Hazel Henderson, said that it just freaked her out to think people can barely drive. People can barely drive on the ground. What's going to happen when they get those? And God bless her, because she also apologized in the same conversation for having intentionally backfiled but not thrown away every technology with my name on it when she was head of the OTA, because she said the concept of zero point freaked her out, and this is a very common phenomenon. This Go ahead.
I just want to underscore one thing for the layman among us. There's in a sense there's no controversy about zero point energies and its existence. The controversy is in the practical application, or the accessing
yes.
of it for practical application. And that's where we've seen since, I posted The Secret Life of Nikola Tesla as our movie, and let's go to the movies, because it's a great example of the story of the effort to suppress and stop people who are trying to figure this out. And we've had a century of people being stopped and suppressed and bought off.
Including and especially Nikola Tesla.
Right.
I mean, here's Nikola Tesla in the 1880s, who basically, between his work, well, let's just take the work in Colorado Springs where he completed the first Earth amplifier. Okay, now when he applied for patents, and you know, sometimes people call these Tesla coils, and they tried to duplicate his results without really taking into account that he was creating a kind of extremely low frequency inductive receiver to the Earth's always fluctuating magnetic field. It's a dynamic, it's not a static. Nikola Tesla was the first person to really get the fact that the Earth's magnetic field is dynamic and not static. So he tapped into that dynamic through the Earth amplifier and was able to generate megawatts of power without any fuel. And then he was able to transmit that electrical power without any wires whatsoever, okay? He was able to transmit that electrical power from point A to point B without any wires. Now this came on the heels of his discovery and invention of the AC dynamo, the alternating current dynamo, where he discovered that if he created a wave-like transmission of electrical power instead of this DC blockhead kind of approach that Thomas Edison used, which we have something called I2R losses if you use that, which just means that the resistance is the square of the current, basically. And so it's kind of like, the resistance in DC is astronomical. Things get very hot, and they don't get, and the electrical power is dissipated as heat, and it doesn't want to be transmitted over distance. Well, Tesla realized that he could kind of float the electrons over the wire and transmit them, and therefore they used his technology at Niagara Falls, much to Thomas Edison's chagrin, and of course that was the beginning of a profound revolution. Unfortunately, the people who were running the new fossil fuel economy, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller and the hypocrite. I shouldn't call him a hypocrite exactly. He was worse than that in some ways because he had really betrayed his friend Nikola Tesla, George Westinghouse. Basically, these men decided that we, as a world, as a planet, would not have access to Nikola Tesla's real technologies, which didn't require their fossil fuels. They decided instead that they would use the AC dynamo and overwhelm him. They didn't pay him his royalties on Niagara Falls. Westinghouse begged him for not a forgiveness of a loan, but a delay in the payback of the first $2.3 million that he was owed. The story goes that Tesla signed over the debt to Westinghouse. I have very clear understanding that this is not accurate information. Basically, what Tesla said is I will grant you this delay, but you must pay me ultimately. And so he literally would have been as rich as any of them or richer than any of them just from Niagara Falls, which was a scary proposition for these robber barons who basically had seized control of our economy along with the Federal Reserve. All of this happened at the same time. Is the thing that people really don't get historically sometimes. But I wanted to say something else about what happened with Tesla. And that is that he was marginalized. He was anathematized. In 1904, Tesla was so popular in New York, his articles were appearing on the front page of the New York Times. And he was talking. In 1904, he wrote a beautiful article talking about a worldwide global network of information transfer, of the transfer of pictures, the communication of music worldwide, and the communication of power worldwide, electromagnetic power, electricity. He was talking about this in the New York Times. It was hugely well received. He talked about this being pollution-free, clean energy. He says, otherwise, we're going to poison the air and the water of our beloved planet Earth, and which, of course, which is what we've done. And then, not even a year later, the New York Times wrote an article called Tesla's Follies. And this was about a big earth amplifier tower that he was building with the help, quote unquote, because he'd been cut off from the money that he actually should have been earning as income from Niagara Falls and other projects. He was cut off. And so J.P. Morgan said, I'll give you $250,000 to do this project. Well, not even $108,000 into this. Not even $108,000, he cut him off. But even with that amount of money, because the buying power, as you know and your listeners all know, of the dollar was astronomically higher than it is today, he was able to build a very beautiful tower that was also equally underground as it was above ground. He was able to create a resonant inductive domain tapping into the Earth's magnetic field. And then when he was disenfranchised by Morgan, he actually got a mortgage, believing that people would hear him, believing that people would understand how important this is. And in point of fact, when he got this mortgage, he ultimately was cut off even further and isolated even further, and he went into foreclosure. And I read the trial transcripts, and it's heartbreaking. This was all of our future that Nikola Tesla represented. Nikola Tesla represented a future that was so much more benign than the one we live in, but rather than just cry over that spilt milk, we will only have a future at this point because the damage that's been done is so profound. If there is a popular movement in this country and worldwide where the people of this planet throw off the shackles of the old economy and say to all of our government simultaneously, which is what, I mean, you know, this is the first sign of this is the very intelligent decision of the government of Germany to no longer pursue nuclear. And, of course, the very unintelligent and uninformed decision of the Obama administration, which snuck in these new power plants, which the Bush administration and Dick Cheney and George Bush couldn't even get in when they were in power. I mean, these guys couldn't even get a license for a new plant. And Obama, because he put a big grin on it, you know, and he was Barack Obama, you know, the master of change, of course, which was we all know now was hyperbole, basically got these new power plants licensed. ignoring, and they're ignoring the fact, and this is a little jump from Nikola Tesla, but I have to say something about Fukushima because I've spent so many hundreds of hours on this project since March, especially since number three blew up, which was a MOX or mixed oxide reactor. The disinformation campaign and the subliminals and entrainment that people are being subjected to. I mean, I have people who I've known, one former engineer from Johns Hopkins, for example, out in Maryland, you know, because I'm saying this is actually a global nuclear catastrophe, has completely disassociated himself from me, which is the media
blackout on Fukushima is quite astonishing.
It's amazing to me because the head of the Department of Radiological Studies at the University of Tokyo went in July before the Japanese Parliament and said, look, this is already 37 times worse than Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. This is already at least that much. But, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were nothing compared to this. They really weren't. There are tens of millions of Japanese who will undoubtedly die. I know because I had cancer from being exposed to radioisotopes from the Rocky Flats nuclear disaster in May of 1969, where 8 kilos of plutonium combusted and went into the air and were deposited over Broomfield because the winds at that time blew the plume, which shuts it up to 12,800 feet, and it blew the plume over towards Denver, over Broomfield, et cetera. And basically we did soil samples at a dairy farm, some friends and I who were in, one of whom was in the health physics area, and I was in astrophysics, and this friend of mine invited me to go and do soil samples, and we were idiots, and we didn't even have masks or anything. We just bought little trowels from Ace Hardware and our little, you know, baggies and got soil samples, only to discover upon analysis that, you know, there were 10 to 80,000 times permissible levels of plutonium, americium, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That we had, you know, on a dusty, windy day in this cow pasture, which was one of the largest cow pastures feeding Watts Hardy Dairy in Boulder, so that people are drinking this stuff every day. This is very important for people to understand. People just, in this kind of nuclear accident, people just don't just drop dead usually, unless they're exposed to extreme amounts of radiation, and then they will just drop dead. There's been a few of those at Fukushima. But what happens is that people will die over time. I mean, you know, like my cancer didn't show up for 9 years, okay? And then it took me over 20 years to get rid of, and thanks be to God, I did get rid of it, but it's only because I knew the best oncologists in the world, because I travel so much and I lecture all over the world, and I just have amazing resources thanks to this wonderful process that I'm involved in. But so what I want to tell people is that we must at the same time, as we demand the Obama administration cease all activity in the nuclear industry. Nuclear is not safe. It is not safe now, and it will not be safe in the future. There are some forms that are safer than the older forms. There's no doubt about that, and it would be disingenuous of me to represent otherwise. But we don't need it. We haven't ever needed it. We haven't ever needed nuclear. We haven't really ever needed fossil fuels. Nikola Tesla drove a Model T. I actually saw a film in Montecito, California. This wonderful gal in Montecito invited me to her family's home there, which was a palatial, from my perspective, a kind of palatial turn-of-the-century estate. And the old horse barns had been, partially had been converted into garages, et cetera. And under a tarp in one of the garages was one of the two Westinghouse Tesla cars that ran without any fuel whatsoever. And she had this great movie of her as a young woman in her lace, beautiful lace dress, you know, and her little parasol and the whole thing, riding with Nikola Tesla in this car, which again required no fuel whatsoever and ran like a top. And the second of these cars was just discovered in the warehouse not long ago in Detroit about a year and a half ago. And I don't know what happened to it. But I know that her car disappeared somehow in some conflict over her estate and has not been seen since.
Well, here's the thing I just want to spend a little time on, because
sure.
Adam, both you and I have personally lived through a process where we've seen any kind of innovator go through just hellacious, you know, whether it's people trying to buy you off or trying to smear you or destroy your ability to innovate. And, you know, until you've gone through it and sort of seen it up close, it's hard to fathom, you know, not only how strict the matrix can be, but how many people it can destroy. And,
Yes, absolutely.
You look at the amount of time and energy that's, you know, because the development, let's say we were going to figure out how to get 0 point so that could be practically applied in a way that you could integrate into a human infrastructure, that takes lots of innovators working and communicating in a forum which is open and free.
And that's exactly right. And Barack Obama was there actually as a Trojan horse to prevent that from happening, quite honestly, because I know for a fact Hillary Clinton intended for there to be a rapid development and deployment of these technologies. I mean, she announced as much at a couple different on a couple different occasions, and it made me cringe because it was kind of like, you know, I wish that she had listened to John Lennon better. You play what the people want to hear, and then you play what you need to play. Or you want to play. And yes, we've witnessed this. You've witnessed it. I mean, you know, we've seen you and I have gotten the bejesus beat out of us on more than one occasion for taking a stand for reality as opposed to hyperbole. And so in a culture where the lie is ubiquitous, it is the truth that looks like a lie. You know, it's like somebody says you can tap into this background field and it goes, oh, he's full of it. You know, I don't believe there's an all-pervading field. You know, I'm an atheist, you know, when it comes to the all-pervading field. I mean, this is the kind of thing. But you see, every revolution in human history, in technology. I mean, I used to go back to Galileo a lot because Here Galileo Galilei is standing on the balcony of this beautiful home of his, and he has these bishops there, and he's a very highly respected man. I mean, this wasn't like some nutcase. He was a highly respected guy who had some political gravitas. He had quite a bit of political gravitas, actually. And he has the bishops looking through this very primitive little telescope of his, but even though it was primitive, it could resolve well enough to show that moons were orbiting Jupiter. Well, you see, the dogma at the time was that everything orbited the Earth. You know, the Earth was the center of everything. It was, I call it the ego-geocentric universe, you know, or the geo-egocentric universe. And it's like, you know, mankind, so-called misnomer, was at the center of everything. You know, hell's below, heaven's above, you know, and we're at the center of everything, you know. And the fact of the matter is, we're actually out beyond the dust tub of the Milky Way galaxy.
Right.
We can look at the dust tub. You can't see the Milky Way galaxy the way we can see it and be where we've been told, even right up until classes that were held today at universities around this world, you know, where people are saying that we're positioned in a certain place in the Orion arm of this galaxy. It's nonsense. We can see the dust lane of the galaxy, the dust tub of the galaxy, right across the sky. So even in these little things, there's just lie after lie after lie that for some reason somebody thinks they're going to benefit by. Now, why would anybody do such a thing? And basically, how much more empowered would we be if we could actually join together? I mean, people.
Well, it's
people
very interesting
are,
that the debt, the you know, if you include all the fraud, the debt has reached a point where, you know, there are two ways out. One is to bring in new technology, or the other is to depopulate.
Yeah,
so,
right. And the only,
you know,
and,
I would
and,
prefer
and
not to be depopulated.
Well, and unfortunately, and I love the fact that you're always so positive, but unfortunately, we've already created such imbalance that a certain amount of depopulation is almost inevitable at this point. But it is not necessary for this to be. I mean, you know, because you know me for long enough now to know that. I mean, I've been since the late 70s, early 80s, I've been going around saying, look at these people who have seized control of our governments are creating a global Auschwitz. And I'm not saying this so I can, you know, as hyperbole or as melodrama.
John Rappaport, and I just filmed a video. He says, it's like Auschwitz, but it's like a hotel.
Right.
Step up and get your vaccine.
It's like instead of Himmler looking down the chute while the people were getting hit with Zyklon B in the gas chamber, we've got the global banking hegemony looking down the chute as we all get gassed, as we all get irradiated to death, as they pretend it's not happening, and they license more nuclear power plants in various countries throughout
the world. Okay, so let me come back to Zero Point, because I really want to finish Zero Point. You worked for many years with Bucky Fuller.
Yes.
And was he interested in Zero Point?
Oh, very, of course, yes. Yes, he was. And not only that, but when he saw a demonstration of a version of the first generator, it was kind of an evolution of the first closed-path homopolar, which included a dynamic magnetodynamic brush, but it's too much technical detail to get into. And he saw it work. This is a man who never used profanity. Except for on a couple occasions where he slipped, but he was a very proper kind of guy,
uh-huh.
And you know, almost obnoxiously proper, because you know, I grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago and was not that way at all, and so I was frequently chastised for barnyard language. But the fact is that Bucky was very interested, and he said there could be hell to pay. He was a Navy guy. He was a guy who basically. Had fought in World War I, had been in command of his own little boat, and, you know, came back and found it very difficult to settle back into Harvard again, and basically could not ever settle back into the normal academic world again, and just went off and became highly creative. He had experienced some things that some people would call mystical epiphanies. He at one point had been suicidal, because he was broke and he had a young child, and he decided that his life insurance his family would be better taken care of by his life insurance than they would be by his continued existence. And as he was standing on the shores of Lake Michigan, in the Dunes area, he basically had this epiphany, and in the epiphany, he was given this revelation that he was going to make a difference in the world, and that the last thing in the world that he should do is commit suicide. Having had a good friend of mine commit suicide just yesterday here in Aspen, I can tell you that there's a lot of people that are very depressed right now, and I know that. But you see, you can collapse and kill yourself, or you can remain silent and allow somebody else to kill you, or you can actually become activated about this. And in terms of Bucky's relationship to Zero Point, he only lived for a short while after this particular demonstration occurred. He did talk to, it was funny, I was lecturing down at the UCSD, and then I went to a fundraiser for Project Earth. This is, 1987, I think. Yeah, it was 1987. I was at this fundraiser at this beautiful home in San Diego, or La Jolla. And this guy came up to me, and he was involved with the Good Earth restaurant chain, which was a big deal back then. And it was really one of the first good, healthy, whole food venues for eating out. And I used to have great breakfasts and brunches at the Larkspur Landing one, but I don't want to go off on that tangent. The bottom line is that he said he was a friend of Bucky's. And actually, he was a very good friend of Bucky's, as was Eddie Albert, who Bucky also confided in about this. And he said that Bucky had told him that he'd seen this demonstration, and it was going to change the world. It could change the world, but he was very afraid for the well-being of the young man who had shown him this work. And this was a guy who had, from my perspective at the time, a lot more money than I did. And so I thought maybe he would help, but that didn't ever materialize. But that's okay, because at least he was a witness. But the thing is, Bucky was very enthusiastic about this. Of course he was enthusiastic. Once you see it work, and Bucky was the kind of guy who didn't go into cognitive dissonance when he saw it work. I've given demonstrations when I was still doing demonstrations up until 2000, which is one of the last times I did a physical demonstration was in 2000, so it's 11 years ago now. When I just, it just was like I was so disenchanted with the response that I stopped. But and the reason I stopped is because there was people trying to kill me. A very well-known scientist who I will leave unnamed, who came to this demonstration, who had announced at the State of the World Forum in New York not long before the demonstration that his benefactors were promising $1 billion in funding if I could demonstrate even 1 watt more coming out of something. He stood there and acknowledged that this was working with highly sophisticated, very expensive scientific instrumentation. He said, well, where do you think the extra energy comes from? He was like a lovely young guy at that point. When I say lovely, I mean this in the sense of there's something really beautiful when people see this and for a moment at least open up to it. They become like children. I mean, I wept the first time I saw it, to tell you the truth. I found it.
Well, suddenly you realize there's no reason for poverty.
Oh, exactly.
There's no reason for scarcity. Right.
I had this weird thing where it was both, I was disconcerted and also exhilarated at the same moment, because I realized that in point of fact, the physics that's being taught, and people are spending a lot of money sending their kids to Stanford and to Harvard and to Princeton and places, and unless they're dragged into or recognized and brought into Princeton, for example, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Group or something like that, unless they're brought into this group and then they sign these non-disclosures and then they become kind of the property of the United States government and never really speak in public about what they're researching, whether it's whatever the phenomena happens to be. For the most part, you know, they may talk a little bit about psychic research or something, but they don't really disclose about zero point. Zero point is being researched all over the world.
Talk a little bit about patent law and some of the other obstacles to innovation in this area?
Well, it's not so much patent law. I mean, there are people who are saying it's patent law, but it isn't so much about patent law. It's about the avoidance of the letter of the black and white writing of patent law. And this has been going on for a long time. Classification, for example, I had a dear friend, Ed Gray. Ed Gray had created a motor generator set, a cool, very ingenious motor generator set, that produced, well, in one of the earlier evolutions of it, well, kind of a middle evolution, produced 10 times more electrical power than it used. I mean, in terms of actual mechanical energy, okay, he had a motor generator set that you know, took less than 1,000 watts to run and created over 10,000 watts. And I mean, I physically interacted with this and several of the technologies that he had developed. By the time I met him, I was introduced to him by my handler from Naval Intelligence, and it was his handler from Naval Intelligence. I didn't even know, by the way, this guy was a Naval Intelligence officer at the time. And I'm not saying bad things about Naval Intelligence. I am saying that this particular man was kind of, not a very nice person. And Ed, I got very close to Ed. Ed had actually received a patent for this. He had written the patent very carefully, his application very carefully. He didn't use words like free energy or anything like this. He just said a highly efficient, you know, motor generator set that does such and such. And he was awarded the U.S. patent. And it kind of slipped through the cracks. And then people became aware of some publications where articles were written about Ed, where it was clearly witnessed by reporters, etc., that this thing was producing more electrical power than it used, and actually that it was producing enough so that it could run itself and run equipment like your air conditioner or your television or all the stuff in your house, for example. And the next thing that happened to Ed was he was given a no-option command, basically, and he was put in sequestration in Idaho. And he and his family were moved to Idaho, and basically I was told by his handler and my handler that I was going to go join him, and I said something very kind of profane to him. I said, you know, you know where you can put that. And basically he said, you have no idea what you're talking about because we're going to ruin your life, we're going to make your life absolutely miserable. And I said, no, if you try, you and they did, believe me. Next thing I knew is I had no credit. I couldn't make my payments on my house. I couldn't make my payments on my car. I had a lot of money. I mean, I had an Olympic sized pool. I mean, I had a beautiful home in San Rafael on Lucas Drive, you know, not far from Skywalker Ranch. I mean, I was like you were, you know,
Right.
You and I both have gone from relative affluence to, you know, being crushed at a certain point. But I'm just going to say this, and for whatever the belief system of any listener is, I'm going to say this anyway. I sat down and prayed. I didn't make a kind of weepy prayer. I just said, I didn't come to this planet for this BS. And I need help right now. I don't need help tomorrow, because I just wrote a rubber check to PG&E for the third time, and the guy who was there to shut off the power to my house, which was rather large and used a lot of power, the guy who was kind enough to accept what he knew was a rubber check, because he'd taken two other ones from me. In fact, what this naval intelligence officer told me was literally what would seem to be true. But I also knew I am in this field, and this field is not just an abstract philosophical concept or a scientific materialist concept, that it also is the field of spirit. If we realize that we are sitting in this field, that infinity, then the infinite presence is infinitely present everywhere. If you're in your office, if you're in your living room, if you're in your, wherever you are, if you're in jail, I mean, wherever you are, this field is present, and it is the source of all everything. And
right.
So,
we
and
have
so my
to,
suffering,
we have to establish, you know, we have to stand on, and we have to draw the lines. The field can't do that for us.
That's right.
The field can only, can only attract that which we'll stand for.
We have to incarnate love. I mean, you know, and people sometimes say that you shouldn't quote Jesus because, you know, Christianity has been so abused. But I love the statement he said. He said, when they asked him, what should we do when you're gone? He says, love one another as I love you. And it's been so mistranslated as I loved you, like he used to love you, you know, or like, you know, but as I love you. In other words, what I demonstrate, what my incarnation of this love, you have to do that. You can't. There's no vicarious atonement, obviously. He said, if you love one another as I love you, it can be on earth as it is in heaven. You see, this is the active prayer, you know. If you don't love one another as I love you, then you're going to create hell.
Right.
You were going to create hell, and you're
well,
going
and that's
to be
important, 'cause,
in torment.
You know, the more powerful our technology, the more important it is that our intention is honorable. Because
absolutely.
There's nothing worse than...
And this is a huge concern of the power elite, of course, because the power elite say, well, what would happen? Like I said, the head of Office of Technology and Assessment was saying, what are they going to do with zero-point-powered, you know, flying vehicles that we... Because she knows. She knows that the United States government has things that have been reverse-engineered. She knows that the United States government has these remarkable technologies that some people ascribe. Sometimes they ascribe U.S. Air Force vehicles to being alien vehicles. But the point here that is so important, and I pray all the time that more and more people can get, is that this field is not containable. It is not controllable, and that's why it is such a threat. This field is present everywhere, and that's why it can't be, there's no bounded condition for it. And wherever you are in space, not just on Earth, I mean, on Earth, you know, you might be able to inductively couple into the Earth's magnetic field, but in terms of the quantum ether or the vacuum fluctuation background field, wherever you are in space, you can tap into this. And
right, we're kind of talking about an out-of-control world. Now, as you know, I can be fairly suspicious about what's going on, and I would like to know, Adam, does the smart meter and smart panels have anything to do with this?
Go ahead. I don't know exactly what
you're
talking
about. Could they possibly be trying to meter all of this stuff?
I mean, I think that they would love to be able to find a way. I mean, this is why Morgan and the crew basically decided that Tesla should be isolated and why all these other friends, I mean, friends of mine, you know, and people I knew like Hubbard and Gray and other people who have actually reduced to practice these technologies. Yes, I mean, basically this is something that if they could figure out a way to meter it, if they could figure out a way to encrypt the energy so that you had to have the encrypt key and in order to power your house, and therefore the utility could broadcast this without wires. I mean, these are the kind of things. And then they're going to act like heroes, like they discovered it, you know. And I was already told by an extraordinarily, one of the guys who quote unquote runs this planet, who's a very strange character, but he told me one day, he says, you know, we know this is real and we're going to allow it to happen someday, but we're going to allow it to happen with the people we choose for this. And so, yes, the smart meter may very well be a prelude to that. The encrypting of power may be the prelude to that. But the private development of this is essential. The implementation for civilian use is absolutely essential. And just, I mean, the world that I see and have seen for decades now as a possibility because of this is a world where we can take the wisdom, for example, that the people of Israel have incarnated relative to making the desert bloom, but we can extend this without fossil fuels, and take the ocean water, for example, and desalinate it and reclaim the deserts, which are growing miles every year. The Sahara Desert is just marching across Africa right now. And this is something that, you know, they got a couple of years of rain about a decade ago, and one of the top people in the world told me, no, you don't understand, there's actually water in Lake Chad again. And I looked at some aerial reconnaissance stuff from NASA, which I have access to, and actually is public domain, and it did not testify well to the accuracy of his statement. I mean, Lake Chad, a lake the size of Lake Erie, by 1985 had almost entirely dried up, and when Richard Underwood from NASA showed his slideshow and showed this, it was shocking to people. I mean, people were astounded by this. Now, this is 1985, so this is 26 years ago. We are in such an environmental crisis right now. For these guys, for anybody to be pretending that this isn't happening is criminal, and they should be arrested and tried if we had Eric Holder and the Justice Department doing their jobs. But the fact is that they're not. And so the people who are lying to us all about things that could basically bring us out of deficit, what if you have no fuel? You know, I mean, I would add a couple of verses to John Lennon's Imagine song, you know, what if there was no fossil fuels? It isn't hard to see, you know. I mean, it's like, it really, what if there was no nuclear? What if there was no centralized grasp and control of this, but everybody had a little air conditioning size unit in their backyard, if even that much, that size. Let's say it's the size of an air conditioner in your backyard, and it provides you with power. And somebody could lease you that. It's not like you can't create a business. Somebody can lease you that, and you can meter that device. I mean, years ago, we made a proposal in 1989 to some of the top people on Wall Street, right before I spoke at Dow Commercial Auditorium the next day. We made a proposal saying, look, at first, let's just convert all of our utilities to using zero point. The public really isn't educated enough to know how electrical power is generated in the first place. And I wasn't saying this as an elitist statement. This is just a fact. And so nobody's going to even begin to know. They're not even going to begin to know how the power is being generated. And you can convert everything over to zero point, and every plant you build will recapture its entire initial capital investment for construction and the reduction to practice of technologies, et cetera, within the first year. I mean, that's an astonishing statement. You know, the amortization schedule goes, what? You know, these guys were saying, is this really true? I said, well, think about it. What's the biggest capital cost? You know, you have a new coal-fired power plant, and there's this entire infrastructure that's behind that. And, of course, this is incredibly threatening. And it's not just the power elite, by the way, who oppose this. Believe it or not, a lot of the opposition to zero point comes from coal miners and unions. It comes from It comes from the solar, people in the solar industry really don't like the idea of zero point because they're investing all this time, energy, and money in some really cool solar technologies, which I believe are very important in the transition into this new world that we can have. But the thing is that the opposition, we should be really careful, I should be really careful to communicate to your listeners that this isn't just about the banking industry or the corporate hegemony opposing this. This is about people who are on board for alternative energy. I mean, our biggest opposition in my own hometown has come from one of the great gurus of alternative energy. And he's been opposed to anything I say just about since 1986. Without naming names, I can just say it's a very strong statement that I'm making.
So many people work. I saw this with the housing bubble. You know, there's so many people making money and who have expertise within the current model. So when the current model, you know, stops, it's funny, at Hamilton I once asked, I was thinking, oh my goodness, you know, we can take the internet, we can end poverty, we can change the model. And I asked one of the researchers to go off and research how long it took for new technology to get integrated. And he came back and he said it takes 50 years. And it's taken 50 years from the beginning of time. It always takes 50 years. And I said, why is that? He said, that's how long it takes everybody to die.
Well, I think he was, exactly. There's a generation for you. Here's the thing. I mean, Galileo Galilei was convicted of heresy and kept under house arrest until he died. The Catholic Church didn't apologize for that until 1984. That's more than 50 years. Things are happening much more rapidly now, and I think that the gentleman you were talking to is much more accurate relative to this moment. But this is over 100 years now for zero point. It's over 100 years since Nikola Tesla physically demonstrated and patented technologies that actually produced power greater than they used, that tapped into this field. It's over 100 years now. And so this is enough. Enough is enough. And in this new movie that's coming out, Thrive, you know, the byline to the movie is, what is it going to take? You know, I mean, what is it going to take for the human species to say to the people who we allow to run this planet, you know, who lie to us, who commit fraud? I mean, you know, if you had a company that committed fraud in its advertising the way the Obama campaign did the last time, or not just Obama, this goes back and back and back and back and back, there should be an end to this kind of immunity. There should be no executive immunity for lying to the public about what you're going to do. There should be no executive immunity for doing things that are destructive to the planet in any country in the world. And I'm not just speaking to people in the United States. I'm saying wherever we are in the world, we must demand accountability. And the Russians know that zero point exists. They have some of the most brilliant zero point scientists in the world, for God's sakes. Extraordinary, extraordinary brilliance. Incredible. And I don't know what the current state of affairs for China is. I know that a representative of the Chinese government approached me at a seminar I was at a couple of years ago, and she said that they wanted to build an industrial park around my work. So the Chinese know that this needs to be done. And I'm going to tell you this right now. Any country that does not actively do this research and move into rapid development and deployment is going to be left in the dust. And it's going to be the dust of their own environmental decay. It's so exciting to me, even now, even though, you know, all the history that people can read online about all the things that have happened, it's like, the fact is, it's still exciting me every single day when I wake up to know that this is true. And I worked with Marcel Vogel, who was the most productive scientist IBM ever had. And I worked on the first incarnation of the zero-point module, or the piezo ringing resonance generator, with him. And then for various reasons, because I refused to sign certain non-disclosures and things like that, which were actually not from him, but from certain government entity, I reduced to practice something that was much simpler with a former colleague of mine, David Farnsworth, and who was just one of the most brilliant engineers I ever worked with at that time. And basically, we went to the United States Senate in 1989. We went to the United Nations like a few days later, and we physically, we went to the United Nations first, and then we went to the United States Senate, and. And instead of people coming to our demonstration, we had 100, the Friends of the Earth International was helping us with this, and we had 189, if I remember correctly, RSVPs from senators, congressmen, staff members, et cetera, that they were coming to our demonstration. At the last minute, the Poppy Bush administration, the H.W. Bush administration, Johnson Nunes had the National Security Council in the basement send out a phone tree to everybody to invite people to the White House to hear about Poppy Bush's, President Bush's Clean Air Act proposal, which was a joke compared to 0 point. And so even Brent Blackwelder I apologize for that moment. Even this guy who was one of the head guys at Friends of the Earth, instead of coming to our demonstration, went to the White House because he said, well, when was the last time the sitting president was willing to talk about the environment? And it was like, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, Sam Levin came, and Sam Levin had his glasses down on the end of his nose, and he goes, so where's the energy come from? And I said, right, exactly. I said, it comes from the space that we're in right now. It's free in terms of there's no fuel that's being consumed. And he just walked away kind of shaking his head. Five people showed up to our demonstration at the Senate Banking and Finance Committee hearing room instead of the 189 people who had RSVP'd who were suddenly called to the White House. This is the kind of sleight of hand that's been going on for a long time.
I've seen this happen so many times, not in energy, but another.
Well, what we were demonstrating was the answer to, and I don't mean the exclusive answer like I'm the only guy who knows this. That's nonsense. Nobody owns this, for God's sakes. There's not one of us that has the exclusive right to 0 point.
Can you describe, in certain
sense, that makes it extremely challenging commercially. But
can you describe, Adam, some of the other people who you think are reputable? Because I, you know, every time I delve into this, I really can't figure out who can I trust and who can't?
I actually, you know, earlier we were talking about this, and it's a very hard thing to do, because, like for example, there's a gentleman I've known, Thomas Vallone, and he has actually written some really good stuff about Zero Point. It's not that I agree with everything he writes or anything, but he actually has been involved in this as I have been for decades now. And he presents some very credible stuff. There's another gentleman at the University of Texas, Harold Puthoff, who I have really grave differences with about some things, but he has also been publishing stuff about this since the late 80s, 1987. In Physical Review D, for example, he published a paper called The Zero-Point Vacuum Fluctuation, the Ground State of the Hydrogen Atom as a Zero-Point Vacuum Fluctuation Determined State. The fact that we've been in conversation for months about that issue, you know, Marcel Vogel was a guy, unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Most of the guys that I knew are dead, quite honestly. But Tom Vallone is still around. He's not so much a guy who reduces to practice, but he's a guy who I think has gone through enough of his own epiphany, enough of his self, you know, revelation, I think. I haven't really stayed in close contact with him. The Palm is gone. I wish I could give you a long list. Nassim, I never can remember his last name for some reason. He's in Thrive. Nassim is actually quite brilliant. And actually has reduced to practice some real technologies. There's a couple other people who I won't name because it would endanger their lives, and I mean that.
Right.
Because a couple of people who I know for a fact can do this, and I know for a fact that they have been targeted as I have been. I'm not physically demonstrating these technologies at this present moment because basically I've been told in no uncertain terms that that this is not going to be countenanced. And I've been around too long. There are a lot of people who didn't expect this particular human body to still exist at this point. And they're quite disturbed by this interview, and they're quite disturbed by the movie coming out, and they're quite disturbed by the inevitability of this technology, because I do know that there is a movement afoot, and I do know that this movement is going to catch. I really feel it in my blood. I feel it in my bone. I feel it in my heart that not just the American people, but the people of the world are going to demand this. I know the people in Germany are demanding it. I know that for a fact. I know the people of Austria are demanding it, and in Germany's case, the government's responsive. And in Germany's case, the government happens to be in the best fiscal shape of any house, but of course, unfortunately, they're also, you know, involved in bailing out too many failed case governments. But that's a whole other issue. But
one of the things... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
One of the things that happens to me when I start to, you know, I had a day this week when, you know, one person after another started drowning me with all the negative news. And whenever that happens, you know what I think of? I think of the panel in Switzerland, and I want you to talk about this. You put together a panel on energy technology in a conference that you sponsored last year in Switzerland. And then after the panel, which was one of the most exciting things I've ever seen, we went off into a room with all the different energy engineers and inventors, and we said, okay, how do we change everything? And it was when you saw who was in the room and the talent and the you know, what was possible at very low cost and in a very decentralized way, it was so just holding that vision of what was possible was so exciting. Maybe if you could just talk about the group that you gathered and sort of what we said.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's one name that I was really forgetting, and there's two names actually, and one of them is John Bedini, and you can go online and order kits, and a young man who approached me in Austria at a conference I was speaking at years ago, who was working on his doctorate at Birmingham University in England, basically approached me, and he said, I want to believe in this, et cetera, et cetera. And he went out and online discovered John Bedini and discovered a schematic diagram and he actually built this battery charger that clearly showed him that he was tapping into the background field. And this is something that I always pray for John Bedini's safety and Tom Bearden's safety, former colonel in Air Force Intelligence, et cetera, is how Colonel Bearden is. He's not young anymore, but he's been on the circuit for a very long time and has written some very exciting stuff about this. It's the panel that we had basically included a man who organizes conferences in Europe where people come and discuss zero point technologies, Ed Aufschneider. There was Duncan Barker, who was there, who's a quite extraordinary 29-year-old young man who just got his doctorate. Had a couple of other people there who were trying to do some interesting stuff with hydroxy technology, and basically was kind of it was a well-intended attempt. I had spent all of 1986 basically working with a gentleman who called himself Ewell Brown, which was actually a pseudonym, which had been given to him by an intelligence agency, strange to say, and we worked on hydroxy, which is something that we could touch upon. But what we discussed in that room was basically how do you introduce this to the public in such a way that we, in other words, we know one of the things that we have to do is we need to educate our fellow citizens of this planet because the military-industrial complex, as it exists today, as a parasite on us all, worldwide, is not going to educate us in these technologies. So we have to take it upon ourselves to educate each other. We need huge amounts of funding, ultimately. and not me. I don't want me. I don't want to ever be the Bill Gates of Zero Point or any nonsense like that. But this field needs money. This field needs to be supported. And so we were talking about the issue of support, the issue of funding. And too often it's people who are have a couple $1 million who think they're going to be the next Bill Gates, who say, well, I'll give you $100,000 or I'll give you $250,000. Show me what you can do in your garage. And it's like, you know, excuse me, but, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree. I've done that. I mean, I've actually built things in the garage and with colleagues of mine. And, you know, it didn't turn out all too well because we were incredibly vulnerable. This requires huge political support. I mean, like a fund. We talked about setting up a fund, a worldwide fund, where people could make a contribution, whether it was a nonprofit or whether it was not a nonprofit, because in different countries there's different laws. Like in the United States, if you have a nonprofit that isn't taxed, then you have no freedom of speech. I mean, they've truncated freedom of speech for all nonprofits, basically, unless you're talking about religion, and then that's a different thing. Like maybe we should create a church of the boundless luminosity of infinite space, you know, and basically have as power the churches with zero-point vacuum fluctuation-based technology so the government of the United States of America will leave us alone. But I don't want to also demonize everybody in the government or all government scientists, because I know a lot of good ones who really are disconcerted by the fact that they know about this stuff and they can't talk about it. So I don't want to say that everybody who works for the government is bad in any way, shape, or form. But in fact, the net result of the attitude of our government is they basically work for the hegemony. They work for this power elite. And it isn't conspiracy theory, for Christ's sakes. They're killing a planet, you know? I mean, you know, people who say this is conspiracy theory, I don't know what they're drinking. You know, I don't know what drugs they're taking. You know,
well,
it doesn't make any sense.
You know,
sense
that's
to
been
me.
A way to, if I can make something socially acceptable, then I can keep a lot of people from exploring it or talking about it. That's basically
yes, exactly.
What
it's about. Exactly. And so, yeah, how do you make this a conversation that is socially acceptable? I think Thrive is a good step in that direction. And I think that what we talked about there is, and from the beginning, I mean, from the very beginning of Project Earth, is one of the things that we used to say at the all the way back, was that this is a conversation that needs to involve more and more people. And it's not a conversation about only, oh, woe is me, look at what's happening to the Earth. It's a conversation of what would the Earth look like if we actually implemented an intelligent technology? What would the Earth actually look like? And you know, there's a lot of people in the Pentagon, in Arlington, there's a lot of people in government who know damn well that we have to do something like this. We can't, you know, what are we going to do? Continuing to borrow money from governments that are choking the planet with their pollution from coal-fired power plants, like China, that's putting up a new coal-fired power plant every couple weeks or something, you know? I mean, although I have to say about China, And this is a positive thing I can say about China, they are actually, at this point, being forced by their own people to implement very, very advanced pollution-suppressing technologies at these new coal-fired plants, because people in China are tired of choking.
Right.
So, again, I don't want to demonize China or any other government, or even our own government altogether. I just want to say that this needs to be our conversation. When we go to the water cooler at our office, it needs to be our conversation at the water cooler. When we go to Starbucks, it needs to be our conversation. When we go to church, it needs to be our conversation. Wherever we meet with other humans, we need to incorporate in our conversation this conversation about the fact that there is this all-pervading field of energy which can be tapped into. It isn't like it's actually, sometimes it scares me almost how easy it can be. You know? I mean, our David and my first piezo, when David and I reduced the piezo ringing resonance generator, we demonstrated 54 times more power coming out than went in New York in 1989, I interviewed until 2 o'clock in the morning. I got what one diplomat called the longest standing ovation he'd ever seen at Dag Hammarskjöld Auditorium at the United Nations. But the people who organized that conference were furious with the fact that I had done that. There were fear there. I mean, I just was told by a dear friend of mine who was in Texas with her husband, who actually was part of the organizing committee for that conference, that she was accosted by one of the senior people there right after the standing ovation happened, and it took me an hour and a half to get from the front of the auditorium to the back of the auditorium. And, you know, she was accosted. She says, well, nobody told us this was going to happen, you know? I mean, I addressed the fact that, you know, 50 engineers.
This wasn't supposed to be big.
This wasn't supposed to be big. And I did interviews. John Lilly said he was coming out of retirement. John Lilly was speaking at that same conference, and he said he was coming out of retirement because it was the most exciting thing he'd ever seen in his life. He actually did some ghostwriting, I understand, for Star Trek, not Star Trek, SG-1, Stargate, for the TV show. And I had told him one of the things we called the first piezo ring resistor was a zero-point module. And I was sitting with him in his living room in Maui one day because I'd gone over to visit him about something. And he was watching SG-1, and, you know, you did not interfere with him when he was watching Stargate. And and all of a sudden, one of the main characters, this Colonel Jack, was talking about the zero-point module. And I went, John? And he goes, well, he says, look at, he says, now it's going to become part of the parlance, you know. And it was his wonderful and stealthy way of getting this into the English language. There are zero-point modules that do exist today. They're not extremely complicated. It's not like they're like in one of these kind of wonderful, complicated Swiss watches or something. These are relatively simple things because the field is present. And the atomic structure of the device itself can be turned into a quantum pump. That's one of the things that I like to call it. And there's so much going on right now. There's so much exciting stuff.
I have three things I need to ask you before we close.
Sure.
And the first is, I want to understand cosmology. We know that there have been literally tens of thousands and thousands of very credible witnessing and filming of UFOs and all sorts of flying saucers all over the planet, which are clearly
millions
not running on fossil fuel. They
yeah,
clearly
millions,
are
millions.
Not running on fossil fuel.
Yeah, and I mean, look at, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So what I want to understand is how can we see them, know that, and still act like some kind of technology is not available other than fossil fuel?
Well, I think this also goes back to the entrainment interview that we did shortly, just a few weeks ago. I basically, why is it, for example, in Arizona, when in right after a certain events happened in my life, this giant craft showed up over Arizona and was seen from above Prescott all the way down through the border with Mexico.
We did the documentary Phoenix Lights on Let's Go to the Movies in the Solari Report. That's one of my favorites.
Oh, that's great. And remember former Governor Fife Symington, Republican governor, who lied to the public basically and said, you know, made a joke out of the whole thing. And then later
he admitted
on,
it later.
But later on, he admitted it to Leslie from the, you know, who I met at Cambridge Institute years ago in Massachusetts, and she's just delightful, and she got him to tell the truth, and he said, yes, I knew as soon as I saw this that it was not from this world. This is a huge taboo subject, and I know that I have family members who don't want me to talk about it because they say, well, as soon as you talk about UFOs, you lose all credibility, and there's a reason for this because as soon as you don't go into cognitive dissonance, because not a lot, I believe that 9 times out of 10, I don't really have polls or statistics to prove this necessarily, but I've witnessed it with my own eyes on a number of occasions, that when people see one of these craft, which is obviously not using fossil fuel, as you say, it's not puttering around, there's no flame coming out of it, there's no smoke coming out of it, it has no propellers, it's just hovering there like it's weightless, you know, there's no jet engine, it's totally silent, and it's a mile across sometimes, okay, or even bigger. And it's like the one in Arizona. And tens of thousands of people photograph it and videotape it, and the Air Force sends up these flares while the thing is happening to distract people and create what we call a mask memory. And they tried to convince everybody in the world that actually what they were seeing was not a giant craft flying overhead completely silently, but it was flares from an Air Force base outside of Phoenix. And this is the kind of thing. People are disempowered by this kind of hypnotic suggestion. And then they react violently when somebody talks about UFOs. I had an editor of a really, you know, relatively progressive publication say something really nasty about me a couple of years ago in relationship to Jim George's book, because I talk about UFOs. And when Ambassador George in his 80s came and stayed with me in Maui, as he used to do every year, and he said, you know, I don't doubt you for a moment. You know, I've worked with you for years. And he says, I've seen the technologies work. I've seen you forecast earthquakes, Adam. But he says, I've never actually seen one of these craft. And so I said, well, let's pray that you do. And I got a very excited. So we prayed. We didn't do a rosary or anything, but we prayed in our own way. And basically, several months later, I get this very excited call that's later on in that summer of the same year from him saying, Adam, I'm at such and such a place in Canada, in my, you know, vacation cabin in Canada, and I just saw one, and I have absolutely no doubt about it, and my companion saw it, and he was just delightful and delighted like a little kid. And I just had this happen a couple of weeks ago here at this house with somebody who I was sitting out on the deck with. And it's funny because millions and millions and millions of people have seen these things, and then they don't want to say it to anybody, because as soon as you say it, people, you know, are going to treat you like a nutcase. And the reason why it has behooved the governments of this planet not to acknowledge publicly, really. I mean, the French government said it was going to, and then it kind of released some really relatively mediocre stuff.
Well, the first question you started to come up with was, well, why can't we have this technology?
Exactly. And gee, I would like to have something that runs like that, you know? I mean, are you kidding me? I know for a fact. I mean, I know engineers who worked on these programs who've since retired, and after 2003 were technically no longer under contract not to speak about it, but they still feel absolutely like their life is in danger every time they do. I mean, Stephen Greer has done quite a bit of good stuff with the Disclosure Project, which was actually not started by him. It was started by a whole group of people, aerospace engineers and military people, and Danny Sheehan, for example, was very, very much involved with the organization of that. And you know, Stephen has, you know, put his name on it and kept it going in a certain sense, and that's good in many ways. But we have all kinds of credible witnesses, for God's sakes, to this, you know. We have amazingly credible witnesses, and yet, even though these people are kind of, I mean, some of them are like, why would, there's no reason why they would lie about this. Astronauts, generals, captains, colonels, you know, admirals, I mean, and intelligence officers and scientists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on and on and on. It's like the inmates who have taken over the asylum want everybody to believe that those are the people that are crazy. I'll tell you what's crazy. What's crazy is keeping this technology from the people. What's crazy is continuing to use technologies that are killing us all, instead of using technologies which could heal this planet even at this late date, or go a long way towards making our future much more benign in the face of the great climate disruption we've created. Here's another part of this that's really important, Catherine.
Okay.
And it comes in this thing, and this is why, another reason why I've done Project Earth as Project Earth. And that is that we have this situation where, for example, last year we had these giant tornadoes, which is not the first year we've had these giant tornadoes, by the way. But last year we had like this giant tornado which took out basically the majority of Joplin, Missouri. And we'll never know how many people actually died there, because the United States government has never been lying about people killed at Katrina and all these other disasters. And anybody who lives in the neighborhood knows they're lying. But, you know, this is like the corporate media continues to reinforce it, even though Anderson Cooper will go in Joplin, Missouri, and Gary Tuchman, et cetera, and try to find out how many bodies are on those refrigerator 18-wheeler trailers over there, you know, not allowed to see how many bodies are in there. kept from seeing them, just like Anderson Cooper and those Gary Tuchman and these guys were kept from seeing what was actually going on after the so-called oil spill, which is still going on at a very deep level in the canyon, in the South Mississippi Canyon offshore. It's never, ever, ever really completely been stopped. Only the riser was stopped, and unfortunately my dear friend Matthew Simmons was murdered as a result of his stand on the whole issue. But the fact is that here we have, you know, like a guy who is a relatively likable meteorologist on CNN, Chad Myers, and he's up there saying, one breath he's saying, you know, during the Wolf Blitzer Situation Room broadcast, he's saying, I've never seen anything like this in my whole career. And almost in the next breath, I mean, not that many minutes later, is saying, in a response to Wolf Blitzer, saying, is this the result of climate change? And he goes, no, actually, statistically, there has been no increase in tornadic activity since 1950, which is just not true. It's just not true. It really isn't. In fact, it's only true if you look at the number of deaths that were caused by the tornadoes before there was early warning, okay? And it's not even true then because they're not being honest about how many deaths there have been. We are in an emergency on this planet. We didn't used to have, when we were kids, we did not, and I'm older than you are, and we did not, in our lifetimes, in either one of our lifetimes, we did not have tornadoes that were a mile wide that were happening week after week after week. We didn't have those. Sorry. You know?
The questions have been pouring in. I now have 11 questions to ask you.
Oh, good. Okay. I love
and
questions.
One of them says, stop interrupting Adam. So I'm conflicted because I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to get everybody's questions answered. We just had a wonderful presentation by Dr. Sam Milham on dirty electricity, and he's come up with a question. Electricity has been killing us since Edison, cell towers, and the smart grid will probably finish us off. Any ideas on how to turn things around? Is it possible to use this technology to create electricity, which is a lot safer for us physically than what we're dealing with now?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And there's absolutely no reason, and there never has been a reason, since Nikola Tesla first communicated electricity through the air, electrical power through the air, there's never been a reason for the grid the way it is. And as a matter of fact, we don't even have to communicate electricity through the air because everybody can have their own unit. And not only could they have their own unit, but because it's not being transmitted, you have to remember that the power grid worldwide is like a giant antenna. And the Earth is not a stable planet electromagnetically, and we are orbiting a magnetic variable sun. I mean, we're told it's the main sequence. Everybody who goes to college is told, even in high school, they tell you that this is a main sequence star. And there's a certain narrow definition of main sequence star that you could say this is true about. But, you know, in terms of it's a hydrogen fusion kind of one of the things that happens in the sun, not everything, but one of the things that happens in the sun happens to be that mechanism. But it's also a magnetic variable. And the reason I bring this up relative to dirty electricity is we get dirty electricity from our own sun. We get dirty electricity from our own planet. We get noisy, dirty electromagnetic energy because we live on an unstable planet, magnetically unstable planet orbiting a magnetically unstable star. So the reason why I brought up the QRS when we were talking about entrainment is because this is something that is, I don't sell it, I'm not involved with this financially, I'm not an investor in the company. All I know is that this helps clean up our cells from the drag that is put on by dirty electrical and electromagnetic energy. Yes, we have been killed. He's absolutely right. We are being killed every day. There's all kinds of studies. Nancy and I and other colleagues, we've been, you know, going to conferences for 30 years and more about leukemia being caused in children, especially when you get near high tension power lines. Utility companies don't want this to be known, but it happens to be true. And there are European studies and Scandinavian studies that have clearly shown this relationship between dirty electricity, as I'm sure he discussed in your show. And so, yes, the bottom line answer is yes. The electricity does not have to be dirty. Electricity does not have to be pathogenic. In fact, electricity can be wonderful. I have a great affection for electricity when properly done. But also I know that the utility grid is being used as a transmission carrier for the groundwave transmission system in coordination with the groundwave transmission system. And there's all kinds of noise that is sometimes intentional noise and sometimes unintentional noise, you know, these big spikes that come across and blow your computer out if you don't have it
right.
on a UPS. You know, we always have computers on UPSs, but it's hard to put us on UPSs, okay, or uninterruptible power supplies.
Right.
There are things that we have used for years to help remediate these things in our own bodies, and that's a whole huge thing that I'm sure that you could talk about for hours, just that subject. But the bottom line answer is yes, yes, yes. Electricity can be generated in such a way that it is not pathogenic. And it wouldn't necessarily be 60 hertz cycles, which happens to be a harmonic of the fundamental metabolic rate of our own bodies, or even 50 hertz cycles. We can have electricity that operates much, much more benignly, with more benign waveforms, and with much less dissipation, you know, LED lights.
Okay, so now I've got to do the next 10 quickly. Let me go. The you and I, when we were talking about entrainment technology, we're talking about we both use the Quantron Resonance System, the QRS.
Yes,
and several subscribers got interested in it, and one bought it and then read Dr. Milham's book, and he very strongly recommends against any sort of healing modalities that use electricity. It's probably better to refer to his book. But they then asked a question, and I sent him information on the QRS, and he came back and said, no, you know, I think this is very terrible. So I thought I would just ask you, because, we certainly can't settle it all here, but I thought I'd ask you to comment. Just I forwarded you the information from him, which
he very kindly gave me permission to do. Yeah, no, I understand. And it's with no disrespect for him whatsoever, I understand his trepidation about these things. I have seen that actually the company that used to sell the QRS also, in my opinion, was in a conflict of interest from the beginning of its distributorship, because they sold another device, which we found to be not nearly as effective, quite honestly. There are a lot of so-called healing technologies out there that are just BS and are actually pathogenic and are dangerous. It's very, very, very hard to know. We actually have, for example, when I first started using the QRS, I would look at my blood under a dark field microscope.
Adam?
Did you lose me? Yes, I'm right here.
Okay, good. It just went off for about 10 seconds. Okay, sorry,
go ahead.
That's
very interesting. I mean, we've been very fortunate that this signal has held up as well as it had. I've been in interviews recently where the entire power system went down at the studio. Literally, I'm not kidding. And it was the only place in the neighborhood where the power went down. So I'm very excited that we've gotten this much time, airtime. It's wonderful. So what I'm trying to say is that I understand what his concerns are, because there's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of so-called new age stuff that's out there where people are saying, well, you've got to, you know, da, da, da. We've studied this. I've studied it on myself. I always test things on myself first, always. I never ask anybody else to be a guinea pig. If somebody then wants to join me after I've confirmed to myself that it's not only harmless but beneficial, then that's good. I've watched my own blood go from being sticky, like where the erythrocytes of the red blood cells are sticking together, to in one 8-minute session, looking at another sample of my blood and no longer having this phenomenon called RULO. In other words, there's now a good charge imparted onto the red blood cells. And very benignly, the QRS in particular, again, I want to emphasize, I have nothing to do with this financially, but the QRS in particular uses such weak electromagnetic fields, because it was really based on a discovery by a German scientist named Rudolf Zinsser, that he discovered a certain kind of waveform that the water molecule really responds to preferentially at extremely low amplitudes. So this, unlike many other so-called magnetic therapeutic devices, is an extremely low amplitude device. And I mean, very, very weak signal that just basically induces a mild charge. It doesn't create hyperacidity. It doesn't do any of those negative things that can happen from less well thought out devices. This has been used in Germany now for 30 years almost. I mean, I was at the first meeting between Rudolf Zinsser, the top oncologist in Germany at the time was a guy named Hans Nieper, and a guy named Dr. Koenig, who's one of the two progenitors of the QRS, Rudolf Zinsser being the progenitor and the discoverer of this waveform. And I know for a fact that I've seen literally dozens, myself personally, I know dozens of people who have benefited greatly from this and find themselves to be regenerated. So even though this particular researcher may have had bad experiences with other devices, I would not recommend anything to anybody that I hadn't tested myself for many, many years. And as you know, I'm an anomaly. I've survived an impossible form of cancer and not only survived it, but continued to thrive and continue to
this
day.
Well, I know it was certainly, I have one thanks to you, and it's certainly beneficial for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, you're innervated, you lay down on it. And, you know, I've had doctors come in and lay down on it. And, you know, one guy woke up 3 hours later and said, that's the best sleep I've had in 10 years. And you know, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, because a cardiopulmonary hypertension, I mean, these are things that have now been scientifically verified. And believe me, there's all kinds of things with the FDA.
Okay, so now I have 10 minutes for 9 questions.
Oh, my God.
Are you ready?
I thought we were going to go as long as we wanted.
The recording runs out. We can go as long as we want, but the recording will run out in 10 minutes.
I just ran. Okay, go ahead.
There was one question from someone who didn't understand what Thrive was, and then I have some questions about Thrive. Thrive is a new documentary that's coming out on November 11th, and the trailer is up on the blog. If you do a search for Thrive, you'll find it, or if you go to thrivemovement.com, it's about a two-hour documentary. The trailer is about 2 or 3 minutes, and you'll see a wonderful picture of Adam discussing Zero Point Energy with Foster Gamble, who made the documentary with his wife, Kimberly Carter Gamble. And it's coming out in November, streaming through the Internet for $5 in 9 different languages. So it's very much going to be a global, but the first part of the documentary starts out really and goes into the energy technology, and Adam is one of the people interviewed. And one of the questions, Adam, I got from one of the members of the Soleri team and just came in on the webinar software is, what is that machine in front of Foster and Adam on the Thrive trailer? Is that Zero Pointer Tesla technology?
No, actually it's an animation, very, very nicely done special effect. It's not a technology. We're just talking about the toroidal field as a phenomenon. And I make a statement there that there's enough energy in this space of this toroid, which of course was not there when we were filming, to power the world. And what I was referring to when I say that, when you see the movie or see the trailer, is I'm referring to this extraordinary discovery that we now know is true, that there is just so much energy present in the space that we are residing in, that it's almost hard to conceive of. And in fact, it is hard to conceive of. It's not almost hard to conceive of. I've been doing this for decades and decades, and it's still something that I'm in awe of, you know. And so that thing is not a technology. It's just an animation.
Okay, so we have a wonderful subscriber who posted 2 questions, and I'm going to read sections from them. What Adam is saying is fine, but we need more science information. How is Zero Point harnessed? How can we help in this? In the Vedas, in esotericism, what he's talking about is the etheric field. In Buddhism, it's the field of unity that permeates the whole world. Brahma, God, permeates everything in the world. The quote defining Zero Point is, quote, having permeated the whole universe with one fragment of myself, I remain. she keeps going on, if we could understand the science, we would be better educated in this field of energy, and we could be more intelligent in our conversations around the water cooler.
Well, there's something about this question which basically is it's a very important question, and in fact there's an interesting thing because we haven't really addressed the cosmology question altogether. What we're in right now, and I hope that she can follow this and that everybody can follow my answer here. Over the last couple of decades, we're going through a profound revolution in our vision of cosmology. The field of cosmology, which I've been involved in since I was a teenager, literally, was heretofore, up until quite recently, dominated by people who said before the Big Bang there was no space. Ridiculous statement, I know. I've always felt it's a ridiculous statement, and now the majority of cosmologists agree that's a ridiculous statement. This is all appearing in the midst of infinity. When I met with the Carnegie Institute astrophysicist many years ago, here in Aspen, we sat down and talked. She knew a lot about 1A supernovae, which are consistently happening throughout time. So we can look back in time. Billions of light years ago, we can see 1A supernovae, and we can see how the spectrum changes over time. Very similar spectrum, but it shifts over time. And I was unaware that this data, I said to her in this conversation, I said, you know, doing what you do, there's got to be that. I mean, the 1A supernova should be the sign in the universe that there's an all-pervading field that's acting upon all physical phenomena. She goes, well, the presence of the zero-point vacuum fluctuation field might indeed explain the anomalies we're seeing in our data, because our data indicate that the expansion of our universe is accelerating, and the only way that could happen is if there's a field that is dominating more than gravity all of the universe that we are appearing in. And in fact, then this other cosmologist named Saul Perlmutter coined this term dark energy, which is, I feel, a very unfortunate thing, because it puts it in the Darth Vader realm, kind of visually. It's like the dark energy, Luke, you know? No, this isn't the dark energy. I mean, in somebody mentioned Buddhism, Michelle Quest mentioned Buddhism, Padmasambhava called it the boundless luminosity of infinite space. And, you know, in the yogic tradition, we go through various alignments of our body, and there's now 30 million plus Americans at least doing yoga on a regular basis and trying to integrate their physical body with what we call the pranamaya kosha, or the energetic etheric sheath, and on and on. And basically, this is a way that we can all relate to this. This is a way that we can relate to it scientifically even. The bioenergetic field is another term that is used, you know. And we have this field around us. We have this field which some say is senior to the physical body. Like if you cut off a hand, you'll still feel the hand. They call it a ghost limb. But in fact, what you're feeling is the actual energetic field, or the bioenergetic field of that hand. And that feeling of that bioenergetic field rides on the nervous system. It does not originate from it any more than zero-point vacuum fluctuation originates from mass. So she can look up different papers, the ground state of the hydrogen atom as a zero-point vacuum fluctuation determined state. There's different things that people can look up. And just look up zero-point vacuum fluctuation, or look up zero-point technology, or look up zero-point energy. And don't get diverted by people who are trying to sell you soap.
Tom Vallone's book. Would Tom Vallone's book on zero-point energy help?
Yeah, and it can be helpful, sure. The search for the zero-point can help. There's a number of different books out there. Yep.
Search
for it's not like this isn't there. It's that in terms of the actual state of the development, it is being kept from the public, you know, and people have been killed. I mean, really killed, murdered. And so when she talks about the science on the one hand and needing more of the science so she could be more empowered, what I always tell people is, you know, what we had to do is we had to actually do this. In other words, you have to educate yourself. And you can do that if you take the time and the energy and you concentrate to do it. So educate yourself. Find out about it as much as you can. Demand that the United States government actually allows this technology to go forward in the civilian sector of our economy so that we can begin to displace the horrible parasitic technologies of the last century.
When the website goes up, there's going to be a ton of links, I know.
Yeah, this is a very last moment kind of thing, in my opinion. This is something that people need to not just jump on the bandwagon, but literally educate yourself, literally study, you know, get a good scientific dictionary, go to the library, do whatever you have to do. But when you don't understand a term, look it up. I mean, this is in my family tradition. You know, my parents were seen as some people by not being very nurturing because when I was 5 years old, they used to say, "Dad, what does this mean?" And he'd say, "Look it up." You know, and we need to look it up. We need to actually study this stuff.
Okay, so now we're really out of time, Adam. I have to thank you tremendously for your joining us tonight. This has been absolutely wonderful, and I can't thank you enough. And is there any last comment you want to make before we sign off for the evening?
I have such admiration for your honesty and integrity, and I'm grateful that we were able to have this time uninterrupted. I will thank the divine for that. And
it's a miracle.
Well, and it is a miracle in terms of my recent interview history. and I want to thank your listeners for their patience and their forbearance. And there's no way that in this short period of time we could possibly cover all the aspects of this, you know. But I would love to see the deserts blooming, and I'd love to see our cities clean and safe for children, and have the popsicle industry worldwide be based on an economy of universal abundance instead of universal scarcity, where some have a lot and others don't. I'm not a communist. I don't believe in the old Marxist, Leninist, Maoist modality of existence because it's based on an old industrial model. I believe that we can enjoy universal abundance, all of us together, and this is our birthright. And this is to enjoy the abundance of this rather awesome creation.
Right.
Okay? And I just pray, and I don't know if I will live to see that day in terms of this particular physical body, but I'm amazed at how long I have lived. So, you know, who knows? It could happen. And I just pray that as many of us as possible can live to participate in a process that our children's children's children will look back on this moment and say, thank God, finally woke up, you know.
They did
thank
good.
God. Okay.
Well,
okay.
May it be so. Adam, thank you so much. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, October 6th, we have the third quarter wrap-up. It's the time when I sit back and say, okay, here's where we are, here's where we're going. Please feel free to get your suggestions in on what you'd like me to cover. October 13th, Precious Metals Market Report. I'm sure we have a lot to talk about. And then on October 20th, the wonderful Jamie Johnson, wonderful young documentary maker. We're going to talk about engaging America in a real conversation. He's the heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune who did two incredible documentaries interviewing the wealthy, talking about what do you think about what's going on. It's really quite remarkable. So until we meet again on October 6th for the third quarter wrap-up, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.